Coming up on Philosophy Talk, Lincoln as a philosopher.
We all declare for liberty, but in using the same word, we do not all mean the same thing. If slavery is not wrong, nothing is wrong. As I would not be a slave, so I would not be a master. This expresses my idea of democracy. Whatever differs from this, to the extent of the difference, is no democracy.
The strongest bond of human sympathy outside of the family relation should be the one uniting all working people of all nations and tongues and kindreds.
Capital is only the fruit of labor and should never have existed if labor had not first existed. Labor is superior of capital and deserves much higher consideration.
Those who deny freedom to others deserve it not for themselves, and under a just God, cannot long retain it.
The philosophy of the classroom today will be the philosophy of government tomorrow.
The philosophy of Abraham Lincoln.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk, after the news.
On Thursday, March 7th, join us for the next live recording of Philosophy Talk on the Stanford campus.
We'll be thinking about Shakespeare's Outsiders with David Sterling Brown, author of Shakespeare's White Others.
This event is free and open to the public. Everybody welcome. More information at philosophytalk.org.
That's Thursday, March 7th, 7 p.m. at the Stanford Humanities Center.
And gentlemen in Stanford now abed shall think themselves accursed they were not here.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that began at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Today, the philosophy of Abraham Lincoln.
Ken Lincoln is revered by many as our greatest president. The most eloquent? He's virtually an American saint. But we're going to look at the philosophical ideas, both religious and political, that animated this alleged saint.
John, you sound a little skeptical. I know we're supposed to question everything, but Abraham Lincoln? What's the question about him?
Well, take the second inaugural address. That's carved on the wall of the Lincoln Memorial along with the Gettysburg Address. If you read it, it's really quite chilling. Especially when you think it represents the philosophy of someone who has just pursued a path that led to the deaths of a half million people.
But, John, that's a great address. With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and his orphan, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations. Those words express a noble philosophy, John. Charity, fairness, compassion. Even a sour puss like you shouldn't find much to object to in that.
Well, sure. That's the end of the address, but look at what comes before. Lincoln basically suggests that American slavery is something that happened according to God's plan. And then, after 250 years, God wants to stop it. So he has a civil war, a terrible war, in which every drop of blood spilled by the lash of the whip during 250 years of slavery shall be paid for by the blood of soldiers. That is a frightening picture. Is a particularly frightening image to think that our leader has. He's thinking of himself as but the pawn of a God who decides things and designs things so that first innocent people are slaves for 250 years, and then as payback, half a million folks, the vast majority of whom didn't own slaves and half of whom were opposed to slavery, must suffer and die. I think that's chilling.
Well, that sounds kind of Old Testament to me, an eye for an eye and all that. But, you know, I don't have any interest in defending what seems to have been Lincoln's theology there. But, you know, does it really show how much about who Lincoln himself was and what he truly thought, his real philosophy? After all, this was a political address, addressed to people who were coming to the end of a terrible ordeal, and clearly he was trying to make some sense of it in terms that they could relate to. It's not very clear what he himself thinks, though.
Sounds clear to me.
Well, but if you read the whole thing, if you look at the broader context, it's as if Lincoln lays out a way of looking at things that might bring solace to the suffering believers. You know, it's all God's will, it's all divine providence and all that. But at the same time, he really doesn't commit himself to that. It's not clear that Lincoln gives the answer to a certain rhetorical question that he intends to evoke in the minds of his listeners.
Well, that's a possible reading, perhaps a more subtle reading than I give it. And I admit, we ought to be impressed that an American president could write prose that posed such deep questions in such an artful way. But you know, it's like everything else about Lincoln. There's all these apparent contradictions.
For example?
Well, he believes in government of the people, by the people, for the people, all these echoes of the Declaration of Independence. But then it's the preservation of the Union that matters, no matter what the people in the states that want to secede think. Then there's devotion to life, liberty, and the rights of citizens. But he closed down the newspapers in New York City. He jailed the editors. He suspended habeas corpus. He makes George Bush look like Thomas Jefferson. With malice towards none, he sent Sherman on his march through Georgia.
Well, you know, I have to admit, Lincoln in the Lincoln-Douglas debate said all these really racist things, but he was also a consistent and stalwart opponent of slavery, so there's a contradiction there, too. But maybe the problem is not in our Lincoln, but in ourselves. Maybe we just don't understand what things were like, what options he saw himself presented with.
Well, we're going to get some help on that. In a moment, we'll have help from Al Jeaney of Loyola University, who's been teaching a course on Lincoln and leadership. He'll join us soon.
And of course, we want our audience's help, too. The number to call is 1-800...
You're listening to an encore presentation of Philosophy Talk. The phone lines are closed.
But first, our roving philosophical reporter, April Drembosky, tried to follow the footsteps of the elusive 16th president. She files this report.
Remember the fifth grade, when math class was canceled so teachers could escort their classes to the gym for an assembly? Troops of 10-year-olds squirmed and rose on the linoleum floor until the principal held up her hand, stared, and 400 kids magically went quiet. Then Officer Friendly came from the police department to celebrate seatbelts, or some other kid's father showed up dressed as a pilgrim, or Abraham Lincoln. Kevin Weinert is that guy.
I was just looking in the mirror, in the rearview mirror of my car as I was driving down the road, and I thought, you know, I'm skinny enough, I'm almost tall enough. I have the big nose and the big ears. I could shave off the mustache and be Abraham Lincoln.
Weinert tries to show kids that Lincoln was a real person.
We see him in the pictures looking very serious and stoic. And to get them to realize he was a lively man, he enjoyed a good joke, he liked to laugh.
Once he gets their attention, he turns to some of the thorny myths about Lincoln's philosophy, especially slavery.
As much as he hated slavery, as much as he wanted slavery to end, he wasn't an abolitionist. For his time, he was a progressive. But Abraham Lincoln, by our standard, was a racist.
I asked Weinert if I could speak directly to the 16th president. He pauses.
Can I get my hat?
Then he paces in a circle, hands behind his back.
You know who I am, right? You know my name? My name is Abraham Lincoln.
Mr. President, your hat isn't as tall as I expected it to be.
Many people, when they see my hat, they're a bit surprised. They expect to see a 2-foot-long stovepipe sitting on top of my head. Now, why would people think I'd wear a stovepipe on top of my head?
You were a lawyer, you served in the House of Representatives, and now you're the president. But you had very little schooling. How did you develop your political philosophy?
I did read. My favorites were Aesop's Fables, Pilgrim's Progress, and of course the Bible. And then historical works, biography of George Washington, military history, anything I could get my hands on.
Mr. President, the United States are in the midst of a horrible war. Many believe that Americans are fighting each other because of your position on slavery.
I've been very clear throughout my presidency that slavery is not the issue. We fight the war to preserve this Union. If I can preserve that nation and not free any slaves, I would not free any. And if I could preserve that nation by freeing all the slaves, I would free them. My goal is to preserve the Union.
Well then, what are your views on slavery?
I believe that if slavery is not a sin, then nothing is. It wasn't until a trip to New Orleans I took by a riverboat. I saw the evils of the auction block for the first time. I remember striding away from that scene filled with rage, and I remember saying to a friend, someday I'm going to hit that, and hit it hard.
Mr. President, I've heard you can be quite the funny man. Will you tell us a joke then?
I was debating a man named Stephen Douglas. We were arguing over a lot of things, primarily slavery. The debate got a bit heated. And I remember at one point, Mr. Douglas accused me of being a liar. Well, he didn't say that. He said, Mr. Lincoln is a two-faced man. When it got to be my turn to speak, I came to the podium, I looked at the crowd, and I said, Now, Mr. Douglas, if God Almighty had given me another face to wear, do you think I would wear this one?
With Honest Abe, Abraham Lincoln, I'm April Demboski. Now back to the 21st century and philosophy talk.
I'm John Perry. With me is Ken Taylor.
Our guest is Al Jeanie. He's a resident philosopher at Chicago Public Radio. He's professor of business ethics at Loyola University of Chicago, where he teaches a course called Lincoln and Leadership. Al, welcome back to Philosophy Talk.
Good to be with you again.
Al, you have broad philosophical interests. How did these interests lead you to your current project on Abraham Lincoln?
Well, I've been a history buff for a number of years, longer than I want to admit on the public airwaves, and I've been drawn to leadership studies over the last 15 years of my work in business ethics. And this is Lincoln's bicentennial year, and I was ineluctably drawn to Lincoln as a leader, as a thinker. But the genius that I was able to find in all of this, for the last 3 years I've been reading nothing but Lincoln, to the point of I even know what kind of brownies or cookies he liked, was this wonderful, rich intellectual experience. This was a man of ideas. If philosophers are defined by the people who examine ideas and understand their meaning and consequence, this was a man of real ideas who understood the power of the word and became a leader far beyond his own expectations.
So Al, we all know that Lincoln was born in a log cabin, split logs, was a country lawyer, debated Douglas, freed the slaves, and was assassinated. None of this really explains what you've been pointing out, this real philosophical, thoughtful bit. Where did that come from?
Well, it doesn't. And one of the problems in looking at Lincoln, there's never been any president who's more written about than Lincoln. There's over 14,500 books, and one comes out every 3 minutes as we speak right now in the bicentennial year. But the real problem of studying Lincoln as a professional thinker is to get beyond that icon, get beyond the martyrdom, to get beyond this kind of Hollywood stereotype we have of Lincoln, and that begins with Lincoln as a man in a little town in southern Illinois where he went before he went to Springfield, and he began to read and began to understand that as an adult for the first time in his life.
So tell us, take us into his intellectual journey. I mean, what were the foundational formative experiences and readings and whatever? What shaped him?
Well, this is just as rich as anything that we know about Lincoln, that he began to read literally at the fireside. He would read everywhere. He would read constantly. There are real people talking about stories talking about him behind the plow, sitting under a tree. His father always thought him a lazy man. He said, in a quote, if it weren't for the ciphering and the reading, he'd probably make something of himself in life. And the father didn't understand his need to be an intellectual thinker or a thinker. So, and Lincoln taught himself to think. This is a self-created individual. The only president less educated than he was his successor, Johnson, who learned to read at the age of 19 while he was a tailor.
Lincoln, so you said Lincoln was self-taught, so maybe you just answered my question. Did he have any engagement with the intellectual leaders of his time? And was he shaped by the ongoing currents of intellectual thought, philosophical thought, political thought of his time at all? Or was it
It's not clear that he ever read a form of philosophical work except Burke's writings themselves. That is, he never picked up a form of philosophical text. But in his 40s, he read all of Euclidean geometry, all the Euclidean books on geometry, in order to reshape his logical abilities as a lawyer. Here's what I think is important. His major texts were Shakespeare, the Bible, and therefore the meter of his understanding of words and how he presents words, plays that he could find as much as he can, and then the political writings of the day and the major documents of the United States. He wasn't vastly read, but he read deeply in each area, and he understood, when I'm talking about in his understanding of words, the critical reality of words. That's one reason, for example, he never spoke extemporaneously, even at a trial. He worked that out because he thought the words were uncritical, and as president, refused to speak extemporaneously.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're discussing Abraham Lincoln, the philosopher, with Al Jeanie from Loyola University of Chicago.
Lincoln is revered as our greatest president. You probably memorized his Gettysburg Address in grade school. Well, what do you think of this important but enigmatic man? Give us your questions, your insights, your comments. Join us by calling toll-free 1-800-525-9000.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Philosophy Talk. The phone lines are closed.
Lincoln's Philosophy, plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
No more driver's lash for me. No more. No more. No more driver's lash for me. Many thousands.
Abraham Lincoln freed many people from the auction block. Today, we're discussing his philosophy. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor, and this is Philosophy Talk. Does Lincoln's life and thoughts still influence your life? What do you think of the great emancipator and the founder of the Republican Party? The toll-free number is 1-800-525-9000.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Philosophy Talk. The phone lines are closed.
Or, as always, you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Our guest is Al Genie from Loyola University Chicago.
So Al, today we've got this picture of the political spectrum ranging from left to right, with Democrats left and left of center and Republicans right of center, and working people kind of on the left, except if they're evangelicals, and they're kind of for some reason on the right. CEOs, corporate CEOs, global capitalists on the right. I mean, it's kind of a strange stew, but I'm predicting that it would be very hard to pigeonhole Lincoln in one of these current spots. Tell me if I'm right or wrong about that.
Oh, you're absolutely correct. Mario Cuomo said that everyone has claimed him as a political, you know, as a part of their political legend, part of their past, you know, from Democrats to Republicans to vegetarians to Unitarians, that kind of thing.
Tell me, does he have a coherent, stateable kind of political philosophy? Tell us.
Absolutely. Strangely enough, in his first fireside chat in 1934 by FDR, he quotes Lincoln. He said, "Lincoln believed that the legitimate object of government is to do for a community of people whatever they need to be done but cannot do or are able to undo for themselves or together as individuals. For Lincoln, the purpose of government was to give a fair chance for all, to raise the boats of everyone." So Lincoln was very, very concerned about this. Is the first president of the industrial age, really concerned about the implications of industry and helping people produce and helping people to expand their lives. I would think today he'd probably be closer to a centrist Democrat than he would to be a Republican.
But Al, answer me this. I mean, when push came to shove, his primary value was preserving the Union.
Yes.
And he was obviously dedicated to this idea that the Union would spread from coast to coast, this manifest destiny idea. I mean, the ideals of the Declaration of Independence and even the abolition of slavery take second place to that. What political philosophy leads to that terrific importance on the Union and on the spread of America?
I'm gonna try out an answer. You tell me if I'm getting it all wrong. So he's a Republican. He's the first Republican. It's the industrial age. Maybe he's a globalizing capitalist entrepreneur, exploit all labor, spread capitalism everywhere. You know, is that it?
He was a protectionist.
Well, that's the libertarian response to it, but I'm not sure that's the correct answer. I don't think I agree with the manifest destiny. But Lincoln was committed. He had very basic principles, philosophical principles about politics. One was that a real founding document was not the Constitution. That was the structure by which our commitment was made, and the founding document was a Declaration of Independence. He said then and at that point, we were a nation of peoples that decided to do something. The Constitution, which was the third working document after the Declaration of Independence, or the second formal document, because you had the Articles of Confederation before that, was an attempt to live out. So what Lincoln was concerned about was saving the Union, which we had agreed to and which we had to abide by unless we voted against it. Now, it's very difficult, and I'm not a political scientist. Lincoln probably would have accepted a congressional vote on secession if we could have changed the Constitution. But it wasn't going to work because of the makeup of the nation at the time. But he said you cannot simply abrogate a rule that you chose to live by, which was rationally come to.
We're talking, this is Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the philosophy of Abraham Lincoln with our guest Al Genie from Loyola University in Chicago. We'd love to have you join this conversation. Do so by calling 1-800...
You're hearing an encore presentation of Philosophy Talk. The phone lines are closed.
9917 or email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Al, one of the big issues or one of the big institutions that shapes current American political philosophy is corporations. But corporations were a relatively new thing in Lincoln's time. And as I've been reading some of his speeches, he almost always has something nasty to say about corporations. Did he have a view that is in some ways very lefty about corporations?
Well, that's a very interesting. You got to remember, Lincoln tried over 5,500 of, you know, doesn't matter the exact number of cases in Illinois. And half of his work at the end of his life was all in railroad. And in half of his work, he defended the railroads. And in half of his work, he assaulted the railroads for individuals. He thought corporations were a necessary agent for the development of an industrial state. But he was against the abuses of corporations, very much like Teddy Roosevelt. And so it was a critique of that. I'm not suggesting he ever read Adam Smith. Who does? We only know kind of the outcoming of it all. How many of you actually sit down and read The Wealth of Nations? But Smith argues very, very strongly against corporations as holding companies which can impede the natural competitive motif. Lincoln was a believer in competition. He wanted to maintain that, and he thought it was government's role to do that.
And when I asked you that question about him being a great globalizing capitalist, I thought you'd say something like that, because there are these passages from Lincoln, these quotes from Lincoln, where he actually sounds, if you take the small quote, kind of like a Marxist. He talks about the priority of labor over capital, capital depends on labor, and you know, could never usurp it, and all that stuff. I mean, was he a Marxist?
No, I think he was, if anything, a communitarian, that all wealth came out of labor. And in fact, even the Pope at one point quoted Lincoln in this regard, one of the encyclicals on the notion of labor, that Lincoln believed that the real wealth of the nation were the individuals. Therefore, the role of government was to protect individuals both separately and collectively. And I want to suggest to you that he was so concerned about saving the Union as it was, and although we had California and this huge gap between, you know, Missouri and California, even though they were American territories, I don't think he was consciously worried about any of that. What he was worried about is maintaining the notion of the law. I stepped on one of your lines before, 272 words for the Declaration of Independence. What he was arguing about there was we're fighting this battle to preserve two things, the right of law, three things, the notion of the Union, and the freedom of all individuals.
So Al, in the beginning, Ken and I had a little back and forth about Lincoln's second inaugural. So I just want to shift a little to his thinking about religion, because we know that one thing he did read is the Bible. We know that he very seldom mentioned Jesus. What was going on there? Was this really his? Did he really have this Old Testament picture of what the Civil War was all about?
Well, I think, let's put this in context. I think Lincoln read the Bible as everyone read the Bible in the 19th century, because it was the meter and metaphor by which one participated in public conversations. If you read his speeches, they have the meter and they have the timing of the Bible. He read that to find images that he could share with others. He was a deep thinker. At one point, he wrote a treatise against on atheism, which was burned by his friends because they said it would kill his political career. You're quite right. And there's no reference to him ever using the word
Jesus
Christ.
Was that a defense of atheism?
No, a defense of atheism, that he was an atheist, a non-believer.
Wow.
I really believe that Lincoln was spiritual, but did not believe in a providential God of any kind. And in the second inaugural, what he's saying is, can anybody, because he did believe in reason, he said, like James Rachel, that reason is the only rule in debate between individuals, and the best reasons win. And he didn't understand this war. There was no rational reason for this war. It could have been addressed in another way. And in desperation, after losing 600,000 men on both sides, after losing, you know, one of his children dying in the White House, and one of his children working for Grant, not necessarily in harm's way, he didn't understand these boys dying. And he said, pitifully, perhaps This is God's will. Perhaps we're paying back for slavery. See, so, I don't know anymore.
So it was a subtle thing. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the philosophy of Abraham Lincoln with Al Jeanney from Loyola University in Chicago. 1-800-525.
This is an encore presentation of Philosophy Talk. The phone lines are closed.
And Jimmy in Piedmont's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Jimmy.
Thank you. My comment, which I hope will solicit a comment, is that one can argue that Lincoln would have mitigated his damage to the country by pursuing the Civil War if he had lived by instituting a benign Reconstruction after the war. He did not live, and consequently the radical Republicans took over and decided to punish the South. You can argue that had Lincoln lived, he would have made the country better off on the whole. By instituting a benign Reconstruction.
Jimmy, that's a good question. Those counterfactuals, hypotheticals are hard to answer determinately. If Kennedy had lived, would we have gotten so deep into Vietnam? I don't know. Maybe not. What do you think though? Is there really a determinate way to answer that?
You're right. Counterfactuals. What had happened of this and this? But here's not a counterfactual. Here are two real facts. His vice president the second time was Mr. Johnson, who was a Southerner who stayed with the Union in Kentucky or in Tennessee, excuse me. And so he maintained, and so he thought here would be someone who would be more sympathetic to the Reconstruction. Secondly, who did he make put on the head of the Supreme Court? Chase, his opponent, and the man who had served as the Secretary of Treasury during the first administration, because Chase was a devout, committed abolitionist who thought Lincoln was too far to the left or right in regard to slavery, and he knew that Chase would, in fact, enforce his reform motions. And also, I want to suggest to you, you know, that second inaugural again, he never refers to them as enemies. He never refers to the Confederacy as a Confederacy. He refers to them as the revolutionaries or the people who have seceded, but never as not Americans.
Yeah.
He wanted us back together.
So, but look, you know, Lincoln, so I wonder if you think Lincoln was a man of his time or a man out of time, because the conception of government that seems to lie behind Lincoln seems in some sense to be radically new, because, or in some ways it goes back to the Federalists, but the Federalists were thrown out of office, right? The fact that you could have this union, that the federal government could say you will not leave to the states, that the states weren't kind of, you know, I mean, this was prior to the 14th Amendment, when the states, it wasn't clear that the Bill of Rights applied to the states, and Lincoln, by saying, yes, all this, you will stay in this union. Was he a man out of time, out of his time, ahead of his time?
I think he was a man of logic. I think he was a man of reason. Lincoln believed in the law, not as magic or mythology or metaphysics, but as a procedure by which we conduct civil and civic engagement. And when you want to change a procedure, you change the logic of the law. Again, Lincoln would have been open to that debate. In fact, it says in the Constitution, for grievous reasons, he felt there were no grievous reasons yet for secession. He had not fired a shot. He had simply been elected, and seven states withdraw from the Union. They take Fort Sumner. He says, what's the grievous reason? What have I done? Remember what he did. He waited for the Confederacy to fire on the North. He never declared war on the South. So I think this notion that Lincoln was trying to build a society that was evolving. And I think the one thing is correct. Gary Wills said he redefined democracy, he redefined the role of government, and he redefined our responsibilities in a government.
So Al, we've got an email here from Stephen Palo Alto. He says, both Lincoln and George W. Bush restricted press and personal freedoms. How come what Lincoln did was okay and what George Bush did was bad?
Darn good question.
Well,
maybe they were both wrong.
I think they were both wrong, quite correct. And I think that though Lincoln admitted in open court to Taney and the Supreme Court and in open cabinet sessions, I am breaking the rule. But if I do not break this rule, the nation will fall.
Wait, why do this. Why is he wrong then? And look, if the leader, if the president has the ultimate responsibility for preserving the union.
Right.
And you know, I was no fan of the Bush administration at all, believe me. But, you know, think your way into their heads during that time before they went crazy and went to Iraq. But, I mean, everybody was on needles and pins. Our whole sense of security had been pierced.
That's
there was the anthrax stuff. If you're the leader sitting there, you think, I got to do drastic stuff. And right. Lincoln must have been in something the same situation.
And you're dead right. And I want to state the case in a different way. Lincoln said, technically I'm breaking the law, but as commander-in-chief, I must do this now to save the larger good, the Union. Remember that letter that I think you did quote to Horace Greeley. I will do anything to save the Union because that's a sine qua non condition for all the other changes that must come about, including the freedom of the slaves. So I think he did abrogate standing laws, but not as president, but as commander-in-chief. Again,
let's put that differently. Not as president, but as an extra-constitutional dictator. Right. I mean, the Constitution didn't give him the power to do that. He claimed some mandate of reason, of history, of his own.
Inference. He claimed the logic of inference that what do I do as commander in chief in order to preserve the Union? I must do all in my power and beyond. So he was willing to break particular laws.
So then the answer to Steve must look something like this. Bush and Lincoln are similar in that they went beyond the Constitution and did things that they were not constitutionally authorized to do. They're similar in that they both had beliefs about the urgency of the situation that motivated this. They may differ in that Lincoln's belief about the urgency of the situation might have been right, while Bush's probably wasn't.
That's why an epistemologist is critical.
Right,
I think you're right.
That's moral luck or something, or epistemic love, because as it turned out, Al-Qaeda didn't have a dirty bomb. The Bushies thought that Al-Qaeda was going to come into New York City or someplace like that and detonate a dirty bomb. That's what they were afraid of, stuff like that.
And you know what Lincoln was afraid of? That Maryland would secede, and then that Washington would be totally blocked off on all three sides, and the war would be over before it was begun. So there were more immediate facts. Baltimore was in riots. He sent troops in. Butler hung a couple people in a public place in order to restore the chaos. So Lincoln was acting, yes. Plenipotentiary powers, yes. But I think more immediate, more palpable evidence on this.
So was there a deep thought behind his doing these things, or was it just the urgency? I mean, I don't think George Bush ever had a deep thought in his day. Did Lincoln have some deep philosophical thought behind this?
Yes.
Or was it just the urgency of the moment?
No, I think that's a combination of both. I think Lincoln truly was a deep thinker. Somebody just did a narrative history on Lincoln and a quick narrative entry. It was work, study, duty, and then they killed him. This was a deep thinker. This was a man who lived inside his books, lived inside his head. That's why he wrote everything. That's why he didn't want to get, as president, he didn't want to do anything extemporaneously. He says, because as president, my word becomes significant and an impact on law. Therefore, I must guard and measure my word. Having said that, he had these pre-existing ideas that he wanted to achieve, but His presidency, he managed by the seat of his pants. He responded to the immediacy of what was going on. There's a wonderful quote. And by the way, one of the stimuli for me was William Lee Miller's book, Lincoln's Virtues, an Ethical Biography, a brilliant book as Lincoln as a thinker. And he says, Lincoln didn't look at things as a metaphysician. Lincoln looked at things as a lawyer, a politician. He didn't want to just tease the quintessential essence out. He wanted to understand how this worked and could be operated amongst men. And so his concern was to make something real.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing Abraham Lincoln with Al Jeaney from Loyola University of Chicago.
Lincoln was a great leader with humble beginnings. We'll explore what made him a great leader and where he picked up those skills.
Leadership, Lincoln, and your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues. Can you tell me where he's gone? He freed a lot of people, but it seemed good they die young. You know, I just looked around and he's gone.
We're talking about the philosophy of the great emancipator, Abraham Lincoln. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and our guest is Al Jeaney from Loyola University in Chicago.
Al, we charge a lot for a Stanford education. but the alum we sent to the White House, Herbert Hoover, isn't carved into Mount Rushmore, I'm sorry to say. Well, I don't know whether I'm sorry to say that or not. Now, Lincoln came from the backwoods. He had less political experience even than Obama. Why was he such a great leader? And where did these skills come from?
You know, it's as if Lincoln was spending his whole life in preparation for this 1 5-year period. Although he was a successful lawyer, although he had a life in Illinois, he never aspired to the presidency. He didn't even want the vice presidency, although he wouldn't have turned it down at the end, he suggested. He wanted to be senator of Illinois, which is a very important and powerful position. And, of course, one of the great ironies of history is he ran for the Senate twice and once against Stephen Douglas and then ran against Douglas for the presidency, and he beat Douglas. And Douglas helped him to get the union going in the right way. I think there's no way to absolutely measure this. You know, when he came to office, 15 of his predecessors had been war. There were 15 before him. They had been war heroes and vice presidents and secretaries of state and veterans of Congress. And where did he come from? Well, he came from being what we want our students to be, thoughtful individuals. He came from, you know, when Hemingway said, courage is a good person in a tough situation. Here was a good person who read and thought deeply, you know, and when thrust in a tough situation, tried.
You know, I don't typically subscribe to the great man of history. I think of historical events as shaped by a whole nexus of things, and some person at a place has to make choices that are kind of forced on them by the historical situation. But if there's any kind of thing that would make me believe in the great man theory of history, Lincoln might be one of them. I mean, what do you think about that?
I think that's probably true. I too, am very, very scared of the great person theory of leadership. But Lincoln was perhaps the right person at the right time, and he was standing on a mountain of other individuals. Remember, to the liberals to his left were saying, you're not going fast enough. You're not freeing people. You're not really in there. You're not destroying the South. What's wrong with you?
Yeah.
And here was a measured individual who even said to Stephen Douglas, you know, I want to free you. And remember, right to the end, he was thinking about sending slaves to South America, to Haiti, even back to Liberia.
I know.
But it was because he felt they had the right to be free, but he thought they would never be accepted as our equals in this society.
What a concept. We've got another caller on the line, Edward in Oakland. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Edward. What's your comment or question?
Hi, thank you. I'd like your guest to expand a little bit more on what he mentioned before, that he thought Lincoln had changed our relation to government or our conception of our relation to government. I'd like to know what Lincoln said or did that leads him to believe that. And did Lincoln feel that he was doing that himself? Or is this just something that people say in hindsight? And just some quick history. Lincoln also, during his administration, the Department of Agriculture was established, and the land-grant college program was established. And UC Berkeley is a land-grant college.
That's quite right.
Thank you.
That's really a wonderful question. First of all, let me get the first part of the question again. Can you state that for me?
How did Lincoln change our relationship? He wants you to expand on the idea that
Gary
Wells
changed. I think what's really fundamental here, that Lincoln changed our perception of this nation as the rights of landholders to the rights of individuals. That is, the Constitution protects the property of owners, and including those held in bondage. And the word slave is never used in the Constitution, but those held in servitude, those held in labor, I think those are the three phrases regularly used, that's property. And so the Constitution protects property. He's saying in the Gettysburg Address that the Declaration of Independence really is the true binding commitment of this nation, the rights of individuals to choose government, and that the purpose of this government is to perpetuate democracy and our ability to keep selecting democracy.
So look, obviously, I mean, we don't like to think of American history this way, but obviously the American Republic had two great failures. That was the Articles of Confederation. It came crashing down and was unsustainable. They came up with this Constitution. That, in the Civil War, came crashing down and was unsustainable. That's what Foucault calls a rupture in history. The old way could not go on. And Lincoln, I think, was highly instrumental in bringing about of the collapse of the old way, but there were all kinds of things happening. But the new way emerged as a really complicated... I mean, Lincoln didn't single-handedly... He didn't write the 14th Amendment, right?
So, the
new way was forged in a lot of turmoil, too, right?
Right, but he did craft the 13th Amendment, which he felt that the proclamation freeing the slaves in the South was a wartime issue, but it had to be made nationally, which he did work on and was passed before his death. I think Lincoln was the beginning. I think you're quite right. Lincoln was standing on a mountain of information, feelings, and motions, and he drove them forward. I think Lincoln's picture of America is not fulfilled until FDR. And in fact, I would suggest to you that all these remember, over 100 days ago, all these pictures of our present president with Lincoln beard, or, you know, smoking with a hat and smoking a cigarette the way FDR did, and apparently Mr. Obama would like to continue smoking that cigarette, but that's another debate some other time. I think that in some sense there is a trilogy here. Every generation must redefine itself. When Jefferson said the blood of patriots and tyrants must be spent every 20 years in order to perpetuate democracy, it means that every generation has to redefine itself, not necessarily blood, but intellectual blood. And I think that each generation has to redo it. Lincoln saw this as a critical juncture, which it was.
So Al, you've mentioned this, and Ken mentioned this, this difference between Lincoln on slavery, which he opposed once he was exposed to it consistently throughout his life, and his issue and the issue of really believing in racial equality. Is that something that his views changed on when he came to know people like Frederick Douglass? Did he eventually become someone who really believed not just in the wrongness of slavery, but that the black and white were actually equal as in human potential?
I'm not sure he actually came all that far. Now, Gates suggests from Harvard, if I've gotten his name correctly, the great African-American scholar,
right,
that he slowly came to this position. Frederick Douglass said he took a while to rise, but once he grasped the concept, he never let it go and became our staunch defender. That is the right of freedom, that every man has the right to eat from the fruits of his own labor, part of his policy. But he did not believe that blacks and whites would ever socialize. I don't think he ever raised the issue, are we equal? He just believed we would never be able to socialize, that our differences were class, racially based, and that we would never get over that.
Yeah, and I mean, then there's another thing that Lincoln realized. He realized that if he got 185,000 or so black slaves to join the Union Army, that would be a huge boost in the arms. And that's a part of the story of the Civil War that isn't told enough, right?
You're quite correct. Not only were they soldiers in uniform and did heroic deeds, they were soldiers who were supply soldiers, quartermasters, so on and so forth, that we out-mobilized the South. Now, it's very, very clear they had the better generals, but not the better army. And as recently a very liberal historian said to me, we should have lost, the North should have lost, that Lee had sufficient ability to take us in, that we were so inept. But finally we won because Lincoln understood this more than anyone. We talked about Sherman's March to the Sea. You've got to kill them faster and quicker. Destroy their armies.
Yeah.
Destroy their places. Destroy their sources.
I'm going to go back to just a more general sweeping historical point about America and the evolution of this wonderful country of ours. You know, I actually think of our country as a series of always reconfiguring after crisis, after collapse. When I was young in the 60s, lots of people believed, and I think rightly, our cities were aflame. The student generation was rebelling against the stupid war. Our leaders were filled with folly, and the country looked like it was on the verge of just collapsing. And you know, that's why part of why Nixon got elected in '68, because you know. So I think that's America, you know, collapse, reconfigure, and we should see the Civil War as one huge episode in this collapse and reconfiguring.
I agree with you, but why we are able to reconfigure is because we still believe in the dignity of human rights. We still believe in the principle of democracy. And while though it's tarnished or abused at times, I think we persevere because we haven't given up our core commitments.
Al, let me ask a quick question from our old friend Paul in San Francisco by email. It's not too philosophical, but he says, it's long been speculated that Lincoln had a then unknown genetic disease called Marfan syndrome, which accounted for his tall, thin, gaunt, and awkward appearance. So just as a factual question, based on your reasons, does intelligence have anything to do with this? And does personal charisma have anything to do with this tall, gaunt look?
No, you know, is it Marfan's disease, so on and so forth? Yeah. I don't think so. I don't think it applies, even if it applies there. Could he have had it? Could it have taken him away in the next couple of years? If you see the last pictures of him, you wonder why he's even still alive. I would refer our commentator to the best book on Lincoln's general psychological, philosophical, and physical state, Joshua Wolf Shank's book, Lincoln's Melancholy, and how he was probably bipolar at a point in his life, truly depressed, or, as we would say of some of our majors, a good philosophy major wants to think the deep thoughts, but truly, I think, a melancholic person, very Sartrean, and that's why he seems so depressed. He feels all of this is absurd, and yet we persevere.
So he was very, I mean, he was a, I've read this before, he was a very sort of down kind of guy.
Absolutely.
At many,
absolutely,
many times. Yet and somehow, so he, did he had hope in the face of that or not?
Yeah,
or?
As Sartre had hope. Remember, when the last times I remember seeing Sartre at Vital, he was on the boards in the post-Vietnam era, talking, first he was talking about Vietnam, then he was talking about corporations, so on and so forth. He still fought the great fight. And I think Lincoln was fighting the great fight, but he felt this was all madness and we were making our lives even more absurd
probably,
by our stupidity.
Probably no president, I mean, tell me, I don't know, I'm not a historian, but probably no president in history, maybe FDR in the Depression, I don't know, faced a darker time in
right.
the country.
No, right? No, I think not. I think, as you know, never had the conditions been so poor, never had been anyone so unprepared for it. Even Emerson said, my God, what are we going to do with this man? He, you know, he has no grammar, he has no poise, he has no polish. Well, we're doomed.
Well, if you think of Washington as maybe he wasn't president yet, but he faced some pretty dark times.
Very dark times, and I think I found out the reason why Mr. Washington was our first president. When Mr. Adams met him the first time at the Congressional Conference, he looked at everyone and said, he's tall, let's make him president.
Right. Well, on that note, I'm going to thank you for joining us.
Thank you for letting me.
Our guest has been Al Jeaney. He's professor of business ethics at Loyola University in Chicago. He's the resident philosopher on Chicago Public Radio, author of the forthcoming Sin, Saints, and Socrates, Confessional of a Catholic Philosopher. John, did you learn anything about today?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Al is a very interesting and engaging person to talk to. And leading up to the program, I kind of read and reread a lot of Lincoln's speeches. And, you know, Lincoln does have a philosophy. He doesn't have a philosophy in the sense that, you know, he produces philosophical tracts, but he, in his activities, in his writings, in his practical situations that he comes to, as Al said, as a lawyer, there is a very consistent philosophy that I don't know that I can articulate it, but I'm sure it's
well,
there.
I think you can articulate it, and I think the place you ought to articulate it is on our Facebook page, right, where this growing number of people intensely engage with that, and also on our blog, John, at blog.philosophytalk.org. I hereby invite you to blog about Abraham Lincoln, John Perry.
I will do my best. Now, folks, we not only have the Facebook page and the blog, but you can also download podcasts of our program from our website as well. You may be able to podload downcasts of our program as well, but you can definitely download podcasts. For the final word, we're going to turn to the fastest emancipator in the Union, Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, the mid-19th century gave birth to a new, brash American humor exemplified by Mark Twain and Ambrose Bierce, and some names not so well known today, Artemus Ward and Petroleum V. Nasby. Many of these humorists wrote under pseudonyms. Of course, I wouldn't know anything about that. Artemus Ward was the creation of a writer named Charles Farrar Brown. Ward was a wandering showman traveling from town to town. He described his dreadful little show as, quote, three moral bears, a kangaroo, wax figures of G. Washington, General Taylor, John Bunyan, Captain Kidd, and several miscellaneous moral wax statues of celebrated pirates and murderers, etc., equaled by few and excelled by none, unquote. The humor consisted of Ward's encounters with various real folks and events in the course of his travels. He was hugely popular in his time, and a lot of his humor remains funny today, if you can get beyond the dialect, which is about 150 years overplayed. Samuel Clemens was a big fan of Artemus Ward, as was Abraham Lincoln. Then there's Petroleum Vesuvius Nasby. He was the creation of Ohio newspaperman David Ross Locke. Nasby presented himself as a patriot, a Democrat, and a clergyman. But the writings revealed him as an illiterate, racist, cowardly drunk, and an obsequious seeker of political patronage. His main yearning was to become a postmaster, the patronage plum of choice at the time. As Nasby put it in a petition, quote, first, I want an office. Second, I need an office. Third, an office would suit me. Therefore, fourth, I should like to have an office, unquote. Nasby mocked the ethics of secessionists and presented a figure we still know today, the incompetent, unscrupulous political opportunist. Nasby was the 19th century equivalent of Stephen Colbert, Archie Bunker, and Rush Limbaugh rolled into one. Lincoln loved this guy, too. Lincoln himself was a joker, even a cruel one. In 1842, when he was an Illinois state representative, he took issue with the state auditor, James Shield. He sent a series of letters under the nom de plume Rebecca to the local newspaper calling Shields a conceity dunce and accusing him of being a ladies' man. The humorless Shields found out that Lincoln had written them and challenged him to a duel. Lincoln accepted. Just moments before the duel was to begin, Shields asked for an apology and Lincoln granted it. Lincoln was rather ashamed of his childish behavior and therefore left satire to the professionals. He never ceased liking it, though. Before he read the Emancipation Proclamation to his cabinet, he first read some selections from Artemus Ward. While waiting for the election results in 1864, he read several chapters of the Petroleum v. Nasby papers. And the night he was assassinated, the play he was watching, Our American Cousin, was a popular satire about a Yankee wreaking cultural havoc among stuck-up Brits. John Wilkes Booth, who knew the play, chose to shoot the president during the extended laughter over one of its punchlines. more known for its mockery, perhaps satire can also offer some consolation, on that historic night at least. It's at least possible that President Lincoln died laughing. I gotta go.
The tongue-twisting wisdom of Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2009.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Our directors of research are Daniel Elstein and Cole Leahy. Lael Weiss is our webmaster.
Also thanks to Zoe Corneli, Merle Kessler, Corey Goldman, Jennifer Jensen, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Templeton Foundation. Also from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Four yeses and one more abstention, and the amendment will pass.
You got a night and a day and a night, several perfectly good hours. Now get the hell out of here and get him.
Yes. But how?
Buzzard's guts, man.